Liberation. What does it mean? What does it stand for? How can we actually conflate, as I'm going to do in this lecture, women's liberation with gay rights, with arguably other liberation movements? Well, to liberate usually is defined as making free, ensuring that actually you're giving a kind of freedom to folk who might otherwise not have actually experienced freedom before. Maybe even stronger than that, it's dealing with different ideologies. It's coping with how people are being given the opportunity to have a whole range of activities which hitherto were being deemed to be inappropriate or not suitable. And this interesting connection, which certainly focuses very much in terms of what we now refer to as modern Britain, relating to the women's liberation movement, gay rights, etc., from the cover of Oz magazine, something I'll be referring to during the lecture as it transpires. Oz, a very famous counter-cultural magazine of the 1960s and early 70s, very much using the parody there of Daz, as in whitest whites and so on. So a whole range of other elements being developed within that. But let's again set the scene of Britain 60 years ago in the 1950s and so on. And according to conventional accounts, most people in Britain had been very repressed when it came to matters of sexuality. It was almost a kind of standing joke within Europe that Britain, sorry, we're just so repressed and uptight, it's just not spoken about. So why had this developed? Why had we actually changed from the fairly laissez-faire times of Georgian Britain through to the uptight, some might say, Victorian era? Well, actually, it does tie into the 19th century and the Victorian moral panics of the time, in which certain things were taken for granted. Things which very much related to the position of the church and the state and whether or not it had a say in people's individual lives. And put quite bluntly, sex in marriage was okay. Sex between unmarried teens was not okay. And sex between men was illegal. And that state of affairs effectively went back to the moral panics of the Victorian era. Again, acts that were introduced to actually make homosexuality illegal and so on as a result of moral panics generated by the press of the time and so on and so forth. But then in the 1960s, we have this sexual revolution in which premarital sex became common. Abortion, contraception were on demand, homosexuality became acceptable, and Britain as a country was never the same again. But then that in itself is too simplistic a picture. Otherwise, you know, it would all be finished, would be wrapped up now, we would actually go on to our firework displays at 4:03, end of lecture. No, can't possibly be that simple. The 1950s, as I mentioned, did see quite high levels of ignorance about sexuality. There were a large number of illegitimate births, illegal abortions, shotgun marriages, disastrous relationships, which we saw manifested in plays such as the New Wave plays and films that we saw, again, reflecting the challenges that people were faced in, trapped in loveless marriages. Trapped in marriages that effectively felt there was no future and so on. And many of the issues that were raised here kind of reflected the society of the immediate post-war culture. Many British children received no sex education whatsoever from their parents, and the schools didn't provide an alternative. Put quite simply, sex was not a subject for discussion. At the same time as that official line, lots of people did seem to have had sex before marriage, and indeed sex outside of marriage during the war years. As you might imagine, war had this tendency to really break down moral fibres, because if you're going to die tomorrow, well, you might as well have a shag before you go. Contraception was also available. And actually, we can go back to the 1920s with Marie Stopes, who opened up the first family planning clinic in the United Kingdom. That was entitled the Mother's Clinic, and it was opened at 61 Marlborough Road, North London, in March 1921. So again, something in the immediate aftermath of the Great War, First World War. Marie Stope sold hundreds of thousands of advice manuals. And as early as 1930, the Church of England voted to allow contraception, which actually made it a lot easier for women who didn't want large families. Sexual textbooks were a thriving market. Eustace Chesser, you can see there, How to Achieve Sex Happiness in Marriage, her Love Without Fear, would actually sell 3 million copies by 1964. That was by mail order and through backstreet shops. So although clearly there was a huge market for sexual advice and information, there certainly wasn't an openness about this. It was very much under the counter and not spoken about in public. Many men had always assumed that once married, they could have sex on demand, and that the woman's role was always passive. But by the 1950s and 1960s, these ideas were changing. Maybe this was because women had been more independent during the war years, and many had had affairs. Maybe there was a general weakening of the church that had an impact. Or maybe it was just the demands of a changing world and changing expectations, with changing opportunities. Because there was so much concern that marriages were breaking up in wartime, the Marriage Guidance Council was formed in 1943. Clearly, morale isn't helped if you are off fighting for your country and you find that your partner is effectively cheating on you back home. And the Marriage Guidance Council was designed to help support marriages in trouble and to give guidance on sex. Obviously important, because if marriages failed, the people in them had to soldier on, primarily because divorce was not a readily available, easy option for the middle and working classes. It was far too expensive. You could probably afford a divorce if, in the case of Edward VIII, you'd abdicated because you wanted to marry a divorcee, but other than that, you were in difficulties. And the main grounds for divorce were adultery and desertion. It wasn't until 1969 that the idea of a guilty party was actually dropped, and proof of an irretrievable breakdown was enough to secure a divorce. So in the 1950s, sex outside of marriage certainly happened, but it was still considered immoral by many and sinful by some. People's standards seem to have been high, but most polls suggest that half of those surveyed did indulge in sex before marriage. Now, there were two types of sexual behaviour that created great anxiety in the days of the 1950s, and beforehand as well. Prostitution and homosexuality. During the preparations for the Festival of Britain, which you recall took place in 1950, the authorities were so worried that prostitutes might pester the tourists, they were seen as a threat to social stability, that attempts were made to drive them off the streets, and there were thousands of convictions for street offences. Similarly, homosexuality created a moral dilemma. In April 1954, the government appointed a committee under Sir John Wolfenden, seen there, to examine the treatment of prostitutes and homosexuals in society. John Wolfenden was the Vice-Chancellor of Reading University. He was a Christian who believed in the sanctity of marriage. And he seems to have been so uncomfortable with the words homosexual and prostitute that he actually used euphemisms to refer to them. And the euphemisms were Huntley and Palmas, hence the biscuit tin there. He couldn't even say the names. Not necessarily the best person, you would say, to be in charge of a government committee to actually examine the treatment of prostitutes and homosexuals in society. However, John Wolfenden certainly looked like a man who reflected the moral majority. But he was also increasingly concerned that his son Jeremy was a homosexual. And he actually wrote to Jeremy with two requests. First of all, to ask him to stay out of his way for the time being, and to wear less makeup. The Wolfenden Report was finally published in 1957, after 3 years of investigation. And the committee lamented the loosening of moral standards since World War II. They also moaned about the weakening of the family, which they perceived as the cornerstone of British society. They recommended that the laws on prostitution should be tightened and penalties for prostitution increased. However, they did recommend that homosexuality should lose its criminal status where it was a private affair and carried on privately. Effectively, Wolfenden suggested that where sexual behaviour was public, the state could intervene, and where it was private, it couldn't. In fact, much of the content of the Wolfenden report was ignored. The Sunday Times at the time called it a pansies charter. But the Street Offences Act of 1959 drove prostitutes off the streets and into brothels or cheap hotels. Now, for homosexuals at the time, the law as it stood amounted to a blackmailer's charter. Vulnerable men who were trying to hide their leanings were open to extortion by people who threatened to out them. And the first British film to deal explicitly with homosexuality, Victim, arrived in the wake of this public debate following the publication of the Wolfenden Report in 1957. For Dirk Bogart, who signed on to play the lead character after the first choice had declined, Victim was a brave decision, given the rumours that were circulating about his own sexuality. Officially, many people thought homosexuality was an illness or a mental disorder, and the majority of people were hostile against it. Some upper middle class homosexuals and heterosexuals openly campaigned for change, but it was a long and strongly fought battle. In 1958, 33 eminent political and cultural figures sent an open letter to the Times calling for a reform in the law. They included the philosopher Bertrand Russell, the historian A.J.P. Taylor, and the bishops of Birmingham and Exeter. Now, this group formed the basis of the Homosexual Law Reform Society, tirelessly campaigning for change and pushing a succession of bills that failed in Parliament. So despite the Wolfenden recommendations, the Reform Society, and the great success, actually, of the film Victim, homosexuality still remained an imprisonable offence until 1967. If you were found committing a homosexual act in public, you would be jailed. End of. The Sexual Offences Act of 1967 also didn't make homosexuals equal, it just decriminalised acts between consenting adults aged 21 or above. Cruising, public spaces and cottaging remained offences. And if we look at terms of the rest of the United Kingdom, Scotland didn't actually change their laws until 1980, and Northern Ireland didn't adjust their particular stance on homosexuality as being illegal until 1982. This is simply referring to gay liberation. Lesbianism, according to Queen Victoria, could never occur, so that was a different issue. Meantime, in the United States in the 1960s, change was afoot. And there was a well-established gay community in Greenwich Village in New York, which also had its own gay bar, the Stonewall. But men who visited the Stonewall were constantly being harassed by the police. Until on the 27th of June 1969, there was a response and the gays fought back, with the Stonewall riots of 1969 marking the beginning of what we now know as the Gay Liberation Front. Now this again, just contextualising it, reminding you, after civil rights movements, but also at the same time as the women's liberation movement is gradually beginning to gain pace, etc. This thought, radical though it might seem, in the 1960s, that actually people's sexuality should not determine the way society actually treated them. The Gay Liberation Front was founded in Britain in 1970, and it campaigned for homosexuality to be recognised as a valid sexual orientation. A survey of the under 45s in 1969 by Geoffrey Gora found that only 12% of the population were tolerant of homosexuality. 24% were revolted, 22% pitied homosexuals as people who suffered from an illness. That's a big change to actually start adjusting and working through. Despite the prejudice, and let's be honest, we are talking about prejudice here in the fullest sense of the word, prejudgment, GayLib was very successful in spreading its message. Surveys at the time show that gay men in Britain and the United States amounted to about 3% of the male population. It's 3 in every 100, a small figure, which actually makes the success of the movement also quite surprising. In general, moral attitudes at this time were remaining fairly stable during the 1960s. A quarter of men and two-thirds of women still remained virgins until marriage, and only one in three boys and one in four girls approved of premarital sex. Very few people in Britain were actually promiscuous, and most sexual activity was related to steady relationships. So why this sense that the 60s is just full of sexual deviancy and so on? Well, maybe the media and those histories of journalism has something to do with it. The 60s felt promiscuous, partly because of the way that the media had expanded. James Bond has to have at least three shags per movie, otherwise it's not a James Bond movie, is it? Sex was also being discussed more openly. Lady Chatterley's Lover had effectively broken the barriers of what was deemed to be obscene and had managed to successfully avoid being prosecuted under the Obscene Publications Act. So there was this openness and discussion in which also many more people had more open relationships relating to marriage and developing their own particular areas and sexuality. But nevertheless, this so-called sexual revolution predominantly happened in the newspapers and in the mass media. 77% of those polled at the time still thought that sex got too much publicity. Now, up until the 1960s, feminists had concentrated on specific objectives, such as the vote, equal rights for women, equal rights in education and the workplace, and the value of women as mothers and so on. Women had mobilised twice in the 20th century. First in the First World War, where they needed to actually work in munitions factories and on the land and in various other areas, because quite frankly, Britain needed the workforce. And secondly, in the Second World War, where women would go out into the workplace to keep the war effort going, but from the home front. After the war, the returning heroes needed jobs, and women were unceremoniously basically shoved back into the home. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Happened after the First World War. It didn't, to a greater extent, happen under the Second World War. So what was the image that women were portraying at the time? Well, there we are. Christian Dior and the new look. Dior fashions, obviously one of the premier fashion areas of the time in the 1950s, promoted this new look. This was to demonstrate clothing which would show the new modern woman of the 1950s, demonstrating a new modern outlook on life and attitudes on life. The advertisers would see women as shoppers. Teen magazines, we've already looked at the growth of teenage magazines, pop culture and so on, but teenage magazines were relentless in promoting marriage as the culmination of female success. Because let's face it, you might well have worked outside of the home during the war. You might well have actually gone to university, got a degree. You might have even written books. But ultimately, if you're female, you really want a decent bloke to settle down with, isn't that right? I don't answer the question, I'm just asking it in a rhetorical notion. Women's magazines would revisit the same themes over and over again. How to get a man, how to keep a man, how to create a perfect home, how to stay beautiful, how to raise children, and also seeing the working wife as a possible failing wife. Because clearly you shouldn't be able to do both things. Women would often feel marginalised in industry, where they would type the letters but rarely dictate them. Think back to the Kellogg's commercial that I showed you a few weeks back. In politics, where they would type the letters and make the tea but rarely make the speeches. And femininity, as such, got in the way of business, with feminism getting in the way of the class struggle. It's no surprise, then, that the women's liberation movement emerged out of student politics in 1968, although there were a few noticeable interesting changes before then. Now, much of the inspiration for the women's lib movement actually emerged from the United States, where actually, as I mentioned, the women's liberation movement had emerged out of the civil rights movement. In 1965, the National Organization of Women was set up, and this was followed and established in 1966 by, again, a campaign to address certain key areas. The burning of the bra being a key symbol of this. The bra designed by a man, Howard Hughes, simply to actually push up a woman's breasts to make them more attractive to men because they look more like the backside of apes, which is what it's all about, basically, isn't it? But again, that whole notion of burning the bra, getting rid of that claustrophobic, containing symbol of male domination was again part and parcel of this whole package. Admittedly, the press would trivialise the women for protests such as the bra burning outside the Miss America pageant in 1968. But at the same time, it was quite clear that the National Organisation of Women was a serious organisation that was aiming for equality in society. And the first American National Women's Liberation Conference took place in 1968. Now, in the 1960s, public life and the workplace were still dominated by males. Films primarily had male narratives and male directors. Lots of change there, then. Not. Males controlled television and so on and so forth, with a few notable exceptions, as we've looked at in the past. Females in film and television were usually portrayed as stereotypes. They were women who needed to be protected and rescued by the male protagonists. In James Bond, you could argue that women were mostly window dressing. Even in the world of television, Honor Blackman as Kathy Gale, Diana Rigg as Emma Peel, and I will be showing some episodes of The Avengers, or at least aspects of this, on Thursday's session. Whilst on the one hand being clear examples of emancipated women who would fight for themselves, follow the fashion pages, but also would be independent, actually, they were portrayed in a way that the framing of that independence was pretty much to suggest that they were really just part of the surreal fantasy of the programme itself. So the independence of women in itself was just a kind of made-up fantasy put together for the benefit of programme makers and so on. Kathy Gale was represented as a widow. Emma Peel finally returned to her missing husband, and John Steed would continue working within the civil service, etc. Now, it may not be as simplistic as that, and this is something I want to talk about more on Thursday, because you have a number of other issues here in terms of certainly a popular culture success and an area which was developing this whole area of equality. And one of the key ways in which positive role models can be introduced and developed, arguably we're still doing it, given the Jodie Whittaker furore, etc., over the Doctor Who scenario, but you're still looking at ways in which women are being portrayed in the media and so on. Underground magazines, such as the one that we started off with, Oz, would give space to women, but more often, as you can see in both of these covers, that countercultural space was to use women as sexual icons rather than a promotion of feminism. And many women, perhaps quite understandably, felt marginalised. Oz, in this instance, very much working from a double meaning. One, it's a publication which originally launched in Australia, so you've got Oz there. But actually, in the countercultural drug era of the time, the yellow brick road, which leads to the Wizard of Oz, you've also got a double meaning there that opens up its particular issues and so on. And again, with fairly eye-catching headlines and dynamic, and some might say, in-your-face headlines and so on, this was a way in which at least the sexual issues behind debates could be addressed and talked, taken through, etc. The London Women's Liberation Workshop was actually formed in 1969, again the same year as the Stonewall Riots. And in its first year, the LWLW, London Women's Liberation Workshop, began to publish its newsletter, which was entitled Shrew, as in S-H-R-E-W, as in the Shakespearean reference to the taming of the shrew. Now, the problem of misrepresentation of women in the press, the promotion of female stereotypes, made the existence of publications like Shrew and other prominent feminist magazines such as Spare Rib, which was launched in 1972, all the more important. Because the magazines not only allowed the movement, the women's movement at least, a platform for self-representation, but also on the back of media headlines generated by direct action, strikes, etc., they reached a wider female audience. And feminists' magazines provided alternative to typical women's magazines of the time. And finally, you're beginning to get a transfer onto ordinary women in the street and in the factory, leading to this historic moment, which was captured in cinema a few years back, the Ford sewing machinist strike of 1968. In 1968, those ladies at the Ford plants came out on strike because they wanted equality of pay with men, as opposed to receiving 60% of what a men's wage packet was. They wanted the same amount for the same amount of labour. They actually ended up securing 95% of the rate men were paid. So, from their perspective, it was a success. Now, the two key aspects about this is these women are working class women, quite clearly working class women, and so they actually drew the attention of the press. Trade unions, which had hitherto been very much dominated by men, also began to look at the plight of women a bit more seriously. Again, you've got an interesting ideological left-wing argument here, insofar as it's only the conservative right-wing leading Tory government that's elected two women prime ministers: Margaret Thatcher, Theresa May. By 1969, the Women's Lib movement in Britain was building up around a network of about 70 small groups around the country. They would actually meet in various small groups, and they'd often actually interconnect their own particular interests with the day-to-day work of feminist issues in the home and so on. Many of the members of the groups actually felt stifled by their roles as housewives and mothers. Now, do not think at this particular moment that this is all the start of an easy-going path, etc., because men still had the jobs in the main, they had the money, and they had the power. Women in the 60s married at an average age of 22. Again, mostly pressurised by the happy endings promised in women's magazines and romantic novels. But marriage in many cases wasn't what they hoped for. It also wasn't fulfilling for many. For active women in careers, the pressure to become liberated sex objects was enormous. To equal a male, some critics argued, a woman must be equally sexually liberated. And actually, there was a counter pressure to actually be promiscuous. Arguably, like the pressure of miniskirts and mascara were also seen as new forms of oppression. Now, there is a counter argument to this, which I'll be talking about when we discuss the swinging 60s in a 2 weeks' time, that actually people should have the right to choose what they wear, how they should actually express their sexuality, and so on and so forth. But there's still this sense of concern about, are you part of the sisterhood if you actually choose to be married and settle at home and is somehow being a housewife, somehow betraying the cause and so on. The first Women's Liberation Movement conference in Britain was actually held in Oxford in 1970. And in 1970, the British Women's National Coordination Committee drew up four demands, some of which also were echoed by the transport workers in their strike in 1968, where women bus conductresses were effectively looking for, as you see there from the posters, the whole notion of equal rights and equal pay and so on. But the four demands of the British Women's National Coordination Committee were as follows. Number one, equal pay. Number two, free contraception and abortion on demand. Number three, equal education and job opportunities. And number four, free 24-hour childcare. So number one, equal pay. Number two, free contraception and abortion on demand. Number three, equal education and job opportunities. And number four, free 24-hour childcare. There are many people who would say, even in 2018, we still haven't quite managed to secure those. Those demands were printed on banners and on a petition handed in to the Prime Minister, Edward Heath, on the 6th of March 1971. And when 4,000 women marched through London on the 6th of March 1971, this was the first International Women's Day march, something which continues into the 21st century. In 1970, the Equal Pay Act was passed, the same pay for the same job. But again, in one of those interesting British fudges, The Pay Act was passed in 1970, but didn't actually become law until 1975 to ensure that employers had time to consider the implications. So there's a 5-year lag before the actual act was made law. The undoubted fact remained that even in the 1970s and the 80s and the 90s, women were discriminated against in most areas of life, mostly trapped in low-pay jobs, in low-skill jobs, and so there were many challenges which lay ahead. But the movement was gradually bringing about significant change. And again, to actually address the essay question, to what extent can the movement be considered international? Well, the one criticism about this is, yeah, international in Australia and Melbourne, international in London, yes, international in Los Angeles, yeah, international in Tehran, in Bangkok, in Peking, a little less so, in Moscow. The Sex Discrimination Act, as I mentioned, was passed in 1975, which outlawed sexual discrimination in the workplace. And the Domestic Violence Act was passed in 1976, which enabled married or cohabiting women to obtain a court order aimed at preventing further violence and in excluding violent partners from the home. But whether or not you have a particular view on this, and I'm sure everybody in this room does have one, you've still got to address the notion of whether, when it's seen as an ideology, as a movement, it's really proving to be successful, or whether we've still got a long, long way to go.